Today's speaker is Steve Diamond from the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division here at EPA. Before I turn it over to Steve, I want to remind everyone to put your phones on mute, and if you don't have a mute button, press *6 now, and you can hit #6 when you're ready to ask questions. Again, do not put this phone call on hold. With that, let me just introduce Steve. Steve is a chemist who has more than 15 years of experience, including 4 years in a commercial analytical lab and 8 years in environmental consulting. He joined us here at EPA in 2005 with a specific focus on enhancing the acceptance and use of emerging analytical technologies and sampling strategies. His perspective draws upon years of practical laboratory and field experience to apply EPA's tried approach at Superfund, Brownfields, RCRA, USP, and state remedial sites. Mr. Diamond's efforts have really resulted in the development of numerous EPA case studies, profiles, and training courses that outline successful strategies for the use and understanding of collaborative data sets, adaptive quality control programs, and real-time analytics. Steve holds a bachelor's in environmental science and toxicology from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to Steve.
Great. Thanks, Jean. And again, welcome to everyone, either good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. Let's go ahead and move right to slide 2, since Jean did such a wonderful job in introducing me. Again, this is demystifying the demonstration of method applicability. And I think Jean also did a pretty good job covering logistics. Again, the big takeaway is the mute button issue. Just make sure you have us on mute. You don't have us on hold. So let's go ahead and jump right to slide 3. The DMA technical bulletin. This seminar really is a function of our upcoming publication, the DMA technical bulletin, which I'll discuss a little bit in a little more detail here in a minute. But this subject is near and dear to my heart, and as a member of the Technology Innovation Group here at EPA, and given my background in analytical chemistry and consulting and the use of field analytics, to me, the concept of demonstration of methods applicability helps us overcome some preconceived notions about what can and cannot be achieved through the use of things like field analytics, direct sensing tools, and innovative sampling strategies. So through the use of DMAs and other triad best management and technical practices, what I really hope to show here is that we can move beyond the concept of screening and definitive definitions of data to show how all information sources have value and how, when they are used collaboratively, they can create more powerful and persuasive data sets, and that many of our commonly used analytical methods and sampling designs, et cetera, are not without their inherent problems or difficulties either and can actually benefit from the use of some of these field analytics and direct sensing tools. So really what I hope to achieve is a broadening of our knowledge and expansion of the toolbox that we have available to us as practitioners, and to highlight a bridge to what I'll call a harmonious existence of field analytics, direct sensing tools, and laboratory methods. So the seminar is really to set the stage for the much-anticipated Brownfields Technical Support Center technical bulletin on demonstration of methods applicability on a triad approach. And we're currently finalizing that document. It's actually expected to be released in August of 2008. And there's the address for the BTSC Center and the publication piece. And that technical bulletin is about a 15-page bulletin describing, you know, things like the components of a demonstration of methods applicability, some of the benefits, some of the considerations you might have. It'll provide some examples of common products that you would get from a DMA, some of the data evaluation techniques, and also provides a couple of short case studies to provide some additional information. Again, these bulletins, these technical bulletins that we produce under the BTSC are intended for our more technical project managers and team members, but also non-technical audiences and stakeholders. They can present these bulletins to consultants and service providers and others to ensure appropriate implementation of things like the triad best management and technical practices at their site. And I have the triad symbol up there in the right corner for folks who aren't aware, but triad's the framework that a lot of these technical bulletins are related to, and of course have three components of systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurements. And the DMA is really a focus of the real-time measurements and how we're going to use those to drive dynamic work strategies. The other thing I'll mention before we move on to slide 4 is I just wanted to put a plug in for XRF Month here on the Clue-In Studios, what we're jokingly referring to XRF Month. We've taken the XRF course that has a lot of the DMA concepts that we've developed, and we've turned that into a series of seminars in August. So every Monday and Thursday, from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to be doing a lot of these X-ray fluorescence concepts, and there's going to be a session on DMA specific to XRF, so I would encourage folks who are on the line to try to attend as many of those in the month of August as well. They're specific to XRF, but they're going to get into things like the basics of X-ray fluorescence, representativeness issues, QC programs, dynamic work strategies, and sampling design, all revolving around X-ray fluorescence. So let's go ahead and move to slide 4. And this is the DMA history, and I have a little quote up there from Galileo. I think that in the discussion of natural problems, we ought to begin not with the scriptures, but with experiments and demonstrations. And, of course, we all know what happened to Galileo. He was later in his life, was imprisoned and placed under house arrest. So the takeaway message there is don't mess with the Catholic Church. But the point here is that even with well-understood technologies like X-ray fluorescence, a membrane interface probe, or laser-induced fluorescence, that often stakeholders will not rely on these tools and strategies based on faith alone, but rather you're probably going to need some site-specific demonstrations to understand how these tools or approaches can be used effectively to manage uncertainty at your site and how they can be used collaboratively with other information sources. And the DMA, or Demonstration of Methods Applicability concept, is really founded in SWA 46 methods, and specifically the Performance-Based Measurement Initiative. And this really fits nicely with TRIAD because the Performance-Based Measurement System Initiative conveys what needs to be accomplished, but not prescriptively how to do it. So EPA, in this case, would define PBMS as a set of processes wherein the data needs, the mandates, and the limitations of a program or project are specified, and that those serve as the criteria for selecting appropriate methods to meet those needs in a cost-effective manner. So under a PBMS approach, EPA would specify things like the questions to be answered by monitoring and the decisions to be supported by the data, the documentation that needs to be generated to support the approach, and so on. The other thing that I really like about PBMS is the fact that they recognize uncertainty and the need for uncertainty management. And one of the concepts or one of the components of PBMS is that you have to specify the level of uncertainty that's acceptable for making decisions. And I think that really comes out when people perform DMAs and sometimes can be lost when we look at more traditional laboratory methods that focus on simply analytical uncertainty, but there's a whole host of other components of uncertainty. And so the goal of the DMA is really to establish that proposed technologies and strategies can provide information that's appropriate to meet the decision criteria. And in terms of decision criteria, I mean things like specificity, sensitivity, reliability, ruggedness. There's a whole host of issues that need to be evaluated under a DMA. And when the bulletin comes out in August, those are really specified in a little more detail. So let's go ahead and move to slide 5. So why do you need a DMA? Well, from a TRIAD perspective, almost all TRIAD projects often involve a real-time measurement system, and you really need that real-time measurement system to drive what we refer to as the dynamic work strategy. But from a basic concept, more and more we start to recognize the management of heterogeneity and spatial variability and the like are extremely important for some of these projects, specifically when you're dealing with, you know, a dynamic work strategy and real-time analytics. But how can you manage heterogeneity or spatial variability issues if you don't know that they exist until after you demobilize, which I've been involved with a number of projects that actually happened, that we made the determination that we didn't have a high enough sample density due to the heterogeneity, or there were other issues that we didn't recognize until we came back and looked at the data, you know, months after demobilizing from the field. So the DMA provides an early look at the significance of these potential issues and allow you to establish effective strategies in terms of QA and QC and how you might deal with them. So many technologies still struggle with the stigma of being what's called, you know, what I'll refer to as a screening technology. And X-ray fluorescence, again, that we're going to be doing in August is a really good example because it's actually a pretty well-established technologies. And even with all the information that's out there, many regulators still require fixed laboratory data confirmation. And that's okay, and that's the part of what the DMA is designed to do, is to establish that relationship and give folks a level of comfort with that. So, but these relationships that you develop between your field analytics or your sampling strategies and those laboratory methods allow you, the user, more confidence in your program. You can do things like develop field-based action levels or ranges for when things might be considered clean or dirty or whether you're unsure. If you're in the unsure range, you might do something like target collaborative samples. In other words, determine what samples you might send off for additional analyses. You can look at things like decision error rates and a whole host of issues. And these can, the other thing that's kind of nice is these can actually highlight the fact that fixed laboratory results suffer from the same sampling and subsampling issues that innovative or field methods do. So it's nice to recognize through a DMA sometimes if you're going to have laboratory issues in terms of subsampling within the sample jar and a whole host of other issues. So, you know, the takeaway piece there is stakeholders cannot expect their field methods to compare any better to a laboratory method than they can really expect a laboratory method to compare to two different labs or even within the same lab. So, and the other nice piece that a DMA is going to help you do is it's actually going to help you look at some of the initial assumptions of your conceptual site model. And as an example there, I'll use an X-ray fluorescence example again where one of our tech support sites, we had a XRF site where arsenic was of concern, and conceptual site model was an aerial deposition release. And when we went out to the site to perform the DMA, we were using in situ shots with the X-ray fluorescence tool. We found that when we actually went along fence lines and things like that, we had extreme high numbers or hot spots on one side of a chain link fence and background or non-detects on the other side of the fence, such that we started to call into question some components of the conceptual site model there, but we really had to go back and take a look at, you know, the release mechanisms and understand were there other sources potentially contributing to the arsenic contamination at the site. So that the DMA provides an initial look at some of those conceptual site model assumptions and actually allows you to change your conceptual site model in real time. Some of the other components, things like site investigation, where collection of 20 or fewer samples may be considered appropriate. That might not be appropriate for a DMA. I think actually the next slide. Let's move to slide six. Is a DMA always appropriate? That was actually one of the questions that we got on the technical bulletin, and the simple answer to that is no. There are times when your resources are such that you expect to do a limited sampling event. And the example I gave was the site inspection under Superfund where the guidance indicates that 20 or fewer samples are usually collected for a site investigation. So that's probably not a good place to try to conduct a DMA. But there are other, you know, there are other projects where adequate resources may be there such that mobile or fixed laboratory methods can be provided. And the key there is that sufficient density. In other words, if you have sufficient density to deal with the small-scale variability and the heterogeneity issues, perhaps performing a DMA for a more elaborate field analytical technique is not necessary. But it should be noted that for most applications, the reason a DMA is beneficial is precisely because a particular tool or analytical technique or innovative sampling strategy has been identified as applicable during the systematic planning process to cost-effectively increase data density, refine the conceptual site model, or deal with issues like small-scale variability and matrix heterogeneity that we know can be such large contributors to the overall uncertainty at a site. Finally, I'll just mention on the brownfields application, we had some questions as to whether or not a DMA is always appropriate in a brownfield setting, and the answer there is most often it is. I'm sorry. Slide seven? Oh, yeah, slide seven, sorry. So I wanted to just give a brief indication of the brownfields, definition of brownfields, which is a property, a redevelopment, or reuse, which is complicated by the presence or potential presence of a hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant. And based on that definition, the problem lies in not whether or not there truly is significant contamination, but rather just the perception of contamination. So a DMA concept, the real-time data, and the high-density tools that DMAs are associated with allow for a data density that facilitates timely revitalization. So these data sets are particularly helpful to address stakeholder concerns provide a level of comfort that allows developers and insurance partners and risk partners, as well as public stakeholders and others, to be involved, invested, and reassured with the project outcome. So let's move to slide 8. What's involved with the DMA? Well, unfortunately, I get asked this question a lot, and unfortunately, there is no template for DMAs. The format, timing, documentation, all those things depend heavily on site-specific information and what the intended use of the data is. But they can be, a DMA can be performed rather easily and affordably before mobilization or as an early component of a field program, and we've done it a number of ways. We've done it as a separate piece early on prior to mobilization. We've also done it in the first few days of a mobilization for remedial investigations or a brownfield application. So it really can be done any number of ways. The thing I would say is that the complexity of the DMA should really be commensurate with the expected complexity and scope of the project. So the expected data use and the decisions that you're using, the technologies and strategies that you're using, all of those things play into how elaborate this demonstration of methods applicability needs to be. But we want to go beyond simple technology evaluations to really look to optimize the implementation of these tools and strategies full scale. So we want to be looking at things like sample design, decision and decision unit designations. That's a critical factor, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Things like sample preparation, throughput, how many samples can you get through the various analytical technologies, whether you have a mobile lab, immunoassay, X-ray fluorescence. There are choke points, if you will, through the process, whether it's sample collection, sample extraction, sample analysis, and the DMA allows you to take a look at some of those things and optimize that as part of it. The other nice piece is the data management issue. You get to really take a look at some of the potential issues you're going to have with data management and try to deal with that. And the last piece I would mention on what's involved in DMA is documentation. And documentation is really key. We've used a wide variety of formal and informal means to document DMAs. Some of the more informal methods, such as memoranda of understanding or meeting notes or project websites, have been sufficient to serve to document the DMA process. But these informal methods are particularly useful to document stakeholder participation, such that the stakeholders are presented the data sets, they understand the collaborative nature of the tools that we're referring to, and really informal discussions with the stakeholders or subsequent to the DMA can be used to accelerate document comment, revision, and submission. So that's another benefit. But regardless of the method used, good records are essential to scientifically validating and legally defending the selection and use of analytical methods, and ultimately the conclusions that are based on the data that you generate in the field. So we strongly encourage folks to do a good job at documenting the DMA process. Slide 9. Just a quick demonstration here, or a cautionary tale. I mentioned the unique part of a DMA of understanding your decision and your decision unit. And here on this table on slide 9, we have a data set from some soil samples that were split through various mesh sleeves, and the particles were fractionated through particle size. And here on the right side, on the left side, you see the different particle size. And then they were analyzed by atomic absorption. And as you can see, as the particle size decreases, the smaller particle size, the concentration of lead in the samples goes up. So this has, you know, a tremendous impact on things like what your exposure pathways might be, how you would define your decisions, and what your decision units would be. And by decision unit, I mean the dimensions, the X, Y, and Z components of what that sample is going to represent, or series of samples is going to represent. But also it's going to drive your sampling and your analytical pathways and the like. So if at this particular site, this was a firing range, and the concern was wind-blown dust leaving the firing range and blowing into a nearby residential area. So if that is your exposure scenario and that is your concern, then you would want to focus on that smaller 200 mesh particle size where, as you can see, the concentration's on the order of 2,000 ppm for arsenic, lead in soil. Now, at the same time, if you took a bulk, the larger grain size and analyzed it, you'd get somewhere in the order of 10 ppm for soil. So understanding what your decision is critical in determining how you're going to prep the samples to get a representative sample. So if your action level was 1,000 and you did an AA analysis on the bulk sample, you might get somewhere in the order of 927 ppm. You would consider that clean. But if your action level is 1,000 and your concern is the wind-blown dust, which are the finer, less than 200 mesh particles that pass through that mesh, then you would potentially have a problem here on the order of 2,000 ppm of lead. So understanding what your decision unit is absolutely critical to designing that. Of course, if you were to send this same sample off for a TCLP analysis for disposal in a landfill, your decision would be actually on the bulk sample, which has a weighted average of about 927. So that would have another potential decision. So just a cautionary tale that you really need to know what your decision is and what your decision unit is to define an appropriate sampling strategy. Moving on to slide 10. What to look for? Well, as part of the DMA, first of all, we want to look at effectiveness. Does the tool work as advertised? And I'll give an example of that. I've been involved with some sites where we had some geophysical tools out there, and the example I'll use is ground-penetrating radar that we were promised could see to 15 or 20 feet. We really needed to map the bedrock surface. When we got out there and did the entire survey, and the data came back, they really couldn't see much beyond 8 or 10 feet. So we wound up paying for a survey that did not provide the information that we really needed to make some decisions at the site. So effectiveness is one of those things that you want to look at. And even a very simplified DMA in that case would have helped deal with it. So when you're talking about geophysical tools, things like ground penetrating radar or electromagnetic tools or resistivity, that you might have depth issues, you might have potential interferences. We've had other sites where we had data processing and interpolation and surveying issues. So a DMA, even for the simplest tools, can really be beneficial to make sure that what your expectations are and what the vendors promise you they can do is actually what you'll be able to achieve at the site. And just a simple one-day event on the front side of a survey can really pay off. And I'll mention that there's some strategies, too, to structuring your contracts to do that, and I'll mention those again in a little bit. But the next thing you might want to look for, quality assurance and quality control issues. Given the variability that you see in the DMA, how can procedures be optimized? How can your analytical and sampling procedures be optimized? How do things like variability affect statistically based sampling designs and what your tolerable uncertainty rates are? For example, if you're using a 95 UCL to make decisions and there's a significant amount of variability present in your matrix, what happens? Well, oftentimes the 95 UCL is pushed above the action level, and in such a case, you have difficulty making decisions regarding that when you're using the 95 UCL, because the 95 UCL is actually pushed up over your action level. So with a high-density real-time tool, you may be able to isolate the problems that are contributing to that variability and develop some strategies when you employ these things full-scale to deal with those uncertainties that are creating the variabilities, and try to get your arms around that problem and have a strategy to deal with it in the field. Things like sample support, you know, what is the size, shape, and orientation of the sample? Those are absolutely critical. Are you going to have false positives, false negatives, bias? How are you going to deal with those things? And it also allows you to look at the initial relationships of collaborative data sets to think about the framework for how you're going to develop your QC program. And I have a few XRF examples and an LIF example and some others here coming up. You want to think about matrix issues. You know, what kind of detection limits will you get given the matrix? Are you going to have interference issues? Some direct sensing tools will have direct push limitations. So that's what I mean by the matrix issues as well. It's something like laser-induced fluorescence, you can get actually naturally occurring matter to fluoresce. There's also potentially issues with certain clay materials. So a DMA can really help you determine if you're going to have some of those matrix issues. The other classic example for matrix issues is the presence of arsenic and lead using an X-ray fluorescence tool. That's a classic that we run into X-ray fluorescence, and there are some strategies to try to deal with, both of those being contaminants at a site doesn't necessarily mean that you cannot use X-ray fluorescence at your site. And finally, it allows you to assess alternative strategies as contingencies, and I'll mention that a little bit later as well. So, slide 11, some more benefits. You can augment the planned data collection, conceptual site model development activities. You can test drive those decision support tools and those data management tools, as I mentioned. So that includes things like visualization tools, statistical sampling design tools. All those things can be evaluated as part of the DMA. And the nice part is that you can, plug some of these things in such that your tools are actually communicating correctly. From a triad perspective, or whether you're using some of these real analytical tools, you're going to be generating a tremendous amount of information in a relatively short time. You need to collect that information at the point of generation, get it into databases, and get it into decision support tools so that you can use those to drive dynamic work strategies. And a DMA is really nice to allow you to make sure that the format that comes out of one instrument is able to upload to the database, is able to upload to the visualization tool, and so on. And you can kind of really hone in on what the issues are there as part of the DMA rather than trying to deal with that once you're out in the field and you're going full bore or full scale. So some other benefits, you can develop relationships from direct sensing tools with visual observations. I have an LIF example that I'll show a little bit later. It allows you the flexibility to change tactics as part of the DMA and plan for that as part of your contingencies. Another critical component is that you can develop decision logic for how you're going to drive your dynamic work strategies. And again, I have some examples of that a little later on. And evaluate your contract mechanisms. Sometimes we're limited by what our contracts will allow us to do. And it's important to understand how those contract mechanisms will affect a dynamic work strategy where you may have a fixed number of points that you're allowed to put in the ground, but how are you going to direct those points? So, and then finally, optimizing, sequencing, making sure you have the right staff, load balancing, unitizing costs, understanding what those choke points are for, is it you're able to collect enough samples in the day and the choke point is that you can't get the samples through the mobile lab in time, or you can't get the immunoassays done quickly enough. Having some determination of where those choke points are is really going to help optimize that field effort. Slide 12, we're going to move now into some typical demonstration of methods of applicability products. And the first we have here are some general summary statistics, but the summary statistics from your DMA can really provide an indication of what you might expect in terms of instrument detection limits or reporting limits, potential detection frequencies, which can really have an impact on statistical sampling design. Things like your mean, your median, your min, your max concentrations gives you an indication of what the range of concentrations that you might expect from the samples at your site. And I have a control chart example where we're going to take these summary statistics and actually use them to design a QC program for XRF. Again, you can take these and do some more elaborate things as you see on the bottom there, such as histograms, and scatter plots, box and whiskers, and the like. And those are really nice to, again, refine that conceptual site model.
So before we move on to the next slide, does anybody have any phone lines or questions on the phone line? If you've muted your phone line, you can press #6 to unmute. And feel free to speak up. Okay, if there's no questions on the phone line, again, just a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by pressing the question mark icon located at the top of the slides. And again, we'll take a break in a few more minutes in case there are any other questions that come in through the phones. So, thanks.
Well, hopefully my explanations are so wonderful that the questions aren't pouring in. So I guess that can be construed as either a good sign or a bad sign, but we'll continue on. So again, just some examples there on slide 12, some of the typical summary statistics products. We'll move to slide 13. Again, some typical DMA products. This happens to be an example of a parametric technique, a linear regression. And these are really, linear regression is the most common of the parametric techniques, often the gold standard, if you will, of method comparison, and they're actually very powerful tools, but they can also be a bit misleading, and I have a series of slides after this as to why It's important to understand what linear regressions can do for you. And this example I have on slide 13 happens to be an X-ray fluorescence example, but parametric statistical methods, they use assumptions about the data's underlying shape of the statistical distribution, be it normal, log normal, or other. And if those assumptions are invalid, then they can often lead to some misleading statistical conclusions or conclusions that may be unreliable. So we like to use a variety of techniques. We use both parametric techniques and some non-parametric techniques to look at it. So we'll show some examples of those coming up. But the intent here, again, is comparability. And comparability, the way we use it, is really quantified by establishing the frequency with which results from different techniques agree with each other. And I'll get into comparability a little bit more in depth here. But I did want to touch quickly on regressions. So slide 14. What is a regression line? Well, here we have a very simple example of a regression. And you see here you have a number of paired results, the laboratory number and the real-time number. And the best fit line there that you see in the middle really is the, what you do is all of those individual points off of the line are called a residual. You would square the value, the distance from that point to the line. And the sum of the square of those values is how you determine the best fit line. So the best fit line minimizes the sum of the squares of the distances from those residuals to the best fit line. So it minimizes the sum of the squared residuals. So that seems simple enough, but what people tend to focus on with these regressions is the correlation coefficient. And there are some other ways to look at regressions that are pretty important. So let's go ahead and move to slide 15. I just wanted to mention the heteroscedasticity is a concept based on scatter. And as you can see from this, it happens to be a laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy versus a laboratory result for beryllium. But what you notice there with the scatter is as you get away from the point of origin, as the numbers increase, you see more scatter in the data. And that is really a fact of life for most environmental data sets. So you can fit a regression line to those, and that's okay. The caution I would have for at least understanding heteroscedasticity and why it's important is when folks try to use things like confidence limits or tolerance limits to bracket the regression line. The problem with doing that is that those things assume a constant residual distance from the line. And if you look at that graph, as you get out from the point of origin, the point the scatter becomes greater such that those residuals are larger further away from the y-axis. So when you see regressions with things like confidence limits and tolerance limits on them, they can be a bit misleading because, again, you're assuming that the average distance away from that best fit line is constant along the entire line, and that is rarely, if ever, the case with environmental laboratory or environmental data in general. And there's a really simple physical explanation for that, for heteroscedasticity, and that is that analytical error tends to increase as the concentration increases. So you're going to see more analytical error as your results increase. And so just a word of caution there in terms of using tolerance limits and confidence limits to make assumptions about where points should fall along that entire best fit line. So we'll move to slide 16. Again, I mentioned some of the issues with regression, but where we have the most success using them, and of course XRF happens to be a great example because it does pretty well in terms of correlation, but again, we don't want to focus solely on the R-squared or correlation coefficient value, but we want to take a look and make sure that we're actually using paired results from the same subsample, and that plays into sample homogenization and particle sizing and some other issues. But we'd like the pair results to focus on the concentration ranges that are pertinent to decision making. So if you go ahead and take a look back at that previous slide 15 and you look at that one lab result there above 250, well, if you're making decisions in the range of 50 ppm, It's not as important to have some of those higher values as part of that data set. Those can actually skew a regression line. I'll show you an example of that. But again, back to slide 16, ideally non-detects are either removed from the data set or dealt with an appropriate substitution method, and that is really probably a clue-in seminar in itself of what are appropriate substitution methods for data sets. But depending on the frequency of detections, there are a number of different things you can do. In general, folks have done things like use half the detection limit, and actually the best case you can get is, in the case of an X-ray fluorescence tool, is actually to force the instrument to give you a result even though it's below the reporting limit, and there are ways to do that. But sometimes you are stuck with a number of non-detects, and you do have to deal with those. But the best regression results are obtained when pairs are balanced at opposite ends of the range of interest, and I have a couple examples to show you what I mean by that. No signs of correlated residuals. Again, a good correlation coefficient is nice, and we'd like to see that residual variance, but we know it rarely exists, so it's really unrealistic to make that assumption. So let's move to slide 17, and hopefully this will capture all of those concepts from the previous slide. I have here two data sets, really the same data set. One is the top one is the full data set, and if you were to solely focus on the R-squared value of that data set, you would say, wow, it's got a wonderful correlation coefficient, 0.95. It's great. Well, if you take a closer look at the data, you actually see some of the issues that I mentioned that you'd be aware of in the previous slide, and that are unbalanced data. So in this case, on the top graph, you have a number of points down below the 2,000 range and 2 points up around 6,000 to 8,000 that seem to be dragging the best fit line down. So you don't have a good balance of data across that entire range from 0 to 8,000. You only have a couple of points there at the high end. So that's an unbalanced data set. That's kind of problematic. You also have correlated residuals, and that is any number of points tending to be above or below the line in clumps. And remember, I mentioned those residuals are the distance from each individual point to the best fit line. And if you zoom down there on the close to the y-axis of that top graph, you see that you have some correlated residuals both on the top side of the line in the range of about 1,000 and on the bottom side of the line. So you've got correlated residuals, an unbalanced data set, and apparently poor calibration, because with XRF and ICP, you would actually expect a fairly good one-to-one ratio of concentrations. And if you take a look at the slope, you actually see that it's 0.5, and you really would hope that you'd have a slope close to 1. The other interesting piece is the y-intercept, and that's where it crosses the y-axis. You would expect, when comparing X-ray fluorescence to ICP, for example, that the y-intercept would be positive. And that's a function of comparing a method that has a total number to a method that uses a digestion efficiency in terms of ICP. So you would actually expect the XRF numbers to be a little bit higher. But again, you'd expect a slope close to 1, and here you have it really at 0.54. So it appears if you follow just with your eye what the best fit line would look like, you can kind of see that it actually should be going up a little more steeply than it is. So if we were to take that same data set and trim it, that is, remove those top two data points, and actually focus on the area where we're trying to make decisions, and this, again, happens to be lead, and we're trying to make decisions in the, 200 or 300 ppm range, that you take a look at that bottom correlation, and you've got a nice balanced data set. In other words, you have points all along the length of the line. The correlated residuals are gone. You've got a really good-looking calibration, but actually your R-squared value drops. So if you were to solely focus on the correlation coefficient between these two data sets, you would say that the top one is a better regression, whereas I would argue that the bottom one is actually a much better regression. So just a word of caution in terms of solely focusing on correlation coefficient, but you also want to take a look at your slope and your y-intercept as potentially indicative of problems with correlations. So we'll move to slide 18, and this is another illustration here. I use this in the XRF course. Again, you have three regression analyses here, and you can see if you just look at the R-squared value, you would say, well, what's the best regression? And I'll go ahead and tell you before we move to the next slide that two of these are X-ray fluorescence tools placed against laboratory methods, whereas one of them is actually two different laboratories on the same subsample. And every once in a while I get a savvy person in the course who I say, which one is the lab versus the lab? And they say, the one on the bottom right because it doesn't have as many data points. And, well, that's actually true. If you go ahead and move to slide 19, you'll see here that in this case we were looking at a Niton instrument and an Innovex instrument. But again, if you were to solely focus on R-squared, you would actually see that the two ICP laboratories correlated less well with each other in terms of the R-squared value than either one of the instruments did to the ICP. So just a word of caution that solely focusing on that value can lead you to some misleading results. So keep an eye on the slope and some of the other regression pieces. Let's move to slide 20. Typical DMA, some more typical DMA products. I kind of harped there a little bit on the parametric linear regression technique. But these are some other examples of some of the types of things that we get from DMA products. In this case, on the bottom there is a really simplified version of how we use lower investigation levels and upper investigation levels that we derive from a DMA to use to make decisions in the field. So you have a certain threshold value where when your real-time analytical technique is below that value, you're assured with a certain degree of confidence that it's clean. When it's in a mid-range, there is a range there between your lower and upper investigation levels where you're unclear about what that decision might be, and those make excellent samples to send off for more elaborate fixed laboratory analyses. And then there's an upper investigation level, which above that value, you're fairly, with the same degree of confidence, assured that the sample is indeed above your regulatory action or your threshold value. And the example above that is a data set that was put together from a collaborative data set from a gamma scan walkover and thorium analysis by Alpha Spec. And what they did is they placed the values that they got from the DMA into different bins. And so if you look there at the lowest bin on the left, you see that when the gamma scan count was between the values of 10,000 and 16,000, that the thorium result only exceeded its action level 3% of the time. That was 4 out of 126 samples. So that's sort of one decision. That could be your clean decision rate. And then in the mid-range, between 16 and 20, thorium, between 16 and 20,000 counts on the gamma scan, thorium exceeded the threshold for 75% of the time. If you were to go up to when the gamma scan counts exceed more than 20,000, the thorium numbers exceeded their regulatory threshold 85% of the time. So you start to see how you can develop field-based action levels or decision thresholds to try to deal with some of these. And I have some more specific examples later in the talk, but these are some typical products, non-parametric technique products that you might see from a DMA. So I mentioned comparability a little bit earlier. I gave a definition. I might revisit that. But
slide 21.
Slide 21, yes. Thanks, Gene. But comparability for a number of years there is kind of a vague references and class. So, when we use the term comparability, we're using it a little bit differently, I think, than perhaps some historical ways of using it. We see it as how do we establish the use of field analytics, direct sensing tools, or other information sources as appropriate to the expected decision? And one of those techniques is looking at comparability. So, again, when we use comparability, we're talking about a definition that seems to be escaping me right now that I had on a previous slide. But let's go and take a look at, many of you may be aware of the PARC criteria, the precision, accuracy, representativeness, comparability, and completeness that has been used for a number of years. And the struggle there was, how do you really measure comparability from that PARC definition? And as a person who used to review a lot of QAPs, many of the QAPs that I had seen would use terms like, we will ensure comparability by using previously employed analytical methods. And when we use comparability from a DMA perspective, we don't mean that. We mean the frequency with which results from different techniques agree with each other from a declared reference point, and that is usually a lower investigation level, an upper investigation level, and the like. So different points of reference can be used, but the most common strategy is to establish comparability with respect to the decision that's being made on the data, i.e. the example I gave you with the thorium numbers. So I also have some XRF examples as well. But, you know, and the data can require a quantitative comparability, such as when two data sets are combined to calculate risk assessment, or more often what we do is a qualitative comparability is what we more often do. And that is simply for a compliant, non-compliant type decision, which we're trying to make in the field real time. And we often use those non-parametric techniques to do it. So a little bit of a difference maybe to what folks are used to with comparability, which is from what we're trying to use it for in terms of looking at field analytics and direct sensing tools in a collaborative nature with laboratory methods. So I wanted to go ahead and just do a definition here for weight of, kind of define weight of evidence and collaborative data sets.
On slide 22.
Thank you, Gene. We're on slide 22. From a triad perspective, I like to differentiate between the terms weight of evidence and collaborative data sets, where weight of evidence, we're really talking about combining information from various sources into a holistic picture. So we might use a series of geophysical and hydrogeological and chemical analyses to come up with a more holistic picture of a conceptual site model. When I refer to the term collaborative data, I'm actually talking about using two or more analytical methods to measure the same compound, analyte, surrogate of that compound, or class, which is a little bit different. And the reason that it's different in my mind is because we can use the relationships that we've developed between these collaborative data sets to determine from one method when we need analysis from another method. In other words, when does the XRF value indicate that it would be worthwhile to send that sample off for laboratory analysis? Or when does the immunoassay number indicate that we need a more collaborative data set and we need a fixed laboratory analysis? So that's how we're using collaborative data sets. And so some examples, again, for metals, you could, or for total uranium, you can get it by X-ray fluorescence, gamma spec, alpha spec. All of those things have their inherent values, and they also have their inherent issues. Alpha spec happens to be lengthy, time-consuming, and it's not without its extraction efficiency issues. But when you bring together a collaborative data set that might use X-ray fluorescence, a gamma scan, and alpha spec, you have a really compelling picture. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about collaborative data sets. So the methods are paired so that the strengths of one method can compensate for the limitations of another. So frequently a field method is selected for its ability to provide a much higher data density than you would expect perhaps in using laboratory methods. But the laboratory methods are going to help you achieve maybe better detection limits or better accuracy than the field method would. But when you put them together, the intent of the DMA is that you are going to take this data set and design it such that the marriage of those techniques are going to produce reliable information that is not biased by the effects of heterogeneity, which we see from sampling effects, or analytical inaccuracies, which we also sometimes find laboratory issues. So alternative analytical methods, particularly those that provide results in real time, they can be used to optimize the decision-making process. For example, real-time decisions in high data density with field methods can reduce the volume of material removed during a cleanup by more precisely defining and confirming the actual contamination footprint. Real-time data can, in this way, improve decision confidence and limit surprises after a project is complete. So there is the power of your data set. You have the you have control over the analytical uncertainties with the fixed laboratory methods, and you have a better handle on the spatial and heterogeneity issues that you can deal with in real time when you use a more established or a field method to combine with that laboratory method. So that's kind of the difference that we want to try to get across. Again, some more. If we move to slide 23, some more typical DMA products that we often see. This happens to be an uncertainty calculator that the Navy produced, and there's the there's a standard operating procedures and also a spreadsheet that allows you to make some uncertainty calculations in terms of analytical uncertainty. That is the focus of this particular one, but we've used it on a number of DMAs, and it is really interesting. So if you look here on slide 23, you see all of the different types of QC samples that you can have, calibration standards, laboratory control sample, matrix spike, all of those things. If you have information for a lot of those things and you plug it into the uncertainty calculator, if you move to slide 24, you get outputs like this. So if you take a look at the graph on slide 24, it gives you an indication of where are your greatest uncertainties. And of course, if you look, it happens, in this example, happens to be SLE. If you go back to the previous slide, slide 23, and look at what SLE is, surprise, surprise, it's sample location effects, which we know is often the case. So whether you took a sample from this point in space or you moved over 3 foot and took the same sample, that is your highest uncertainty and is what is driving your overall analytical uncertainty, not things like IME and SPE, which happen to be your intrinsic instrument effects or your spike preparation effects. So it gives you an indication of where your uncertainties are coming from in your analytical process and allows you to establish some strategies as you move forward in the field to deal with those. And the other nice piece, if we move to slide 24, or if you're already on slide 24, you see that the nice piece about it is it'll tell you what, at a specific confidence level, what the uncertainty interval is. So if your measurement in this case was 56 micrograms per kilogram, you could say at the 99% confidence level that is equivalent to any value between 41 and 71 micrograms per kilogram. If you were to go down to with the bias corrected for, that value jumps from 45 to 78. So it allows you to understand where your biases are and also understand if your value is within a certain range at the desired confidence level, you will or will not be able to make a determination as to whether or not you are above or below an action threshold. And that can really lead to those upper and lower investigation levels, like I was saying earlier. So that, let's say in this case, your action level was 50. Well, at the 99% confidence level, if you had a value of 56, you could say anything above 71 is definitely dirty, and anything below 41 is definitely clean at the 99% confidence level. So that's an indication of how you can use these tools as part of the DMA to really hone in on that sampling and analysis strategy as you go full scale. Moving to slide 25, some typical DMA products. This is, I mentioned earlier, how we can use DMA data sets to actually develop QC programs, and we'll talk more about this in the XRF deliveries in August, but this is one that we developed for XRF. But again, you take the summary statistics from your DMA, and again, we like at least 30 or 20 to 30 paired samples or more to really get a good data set for developing the summary statistics. But based on that, you can actually determine what the expected mean is, what 2 standard deviations or 3 standard deviations from that are expected, and then we use that as a control chart to look at our standards as we go. So in the case of XRF, each maybe several times a day or whatever you determine your frequency is, depending on your sampling design for XRF, as you shoot your standards, you make one of these control charts for each standard, for each analyte of concern. In this case, this one was for lead. You can start to see trends or out-of-control situations that require you to reinitialize the instrument and reshoot your blanks and standards to make sure you're back in control. And the nice thing about that is it gives you an indication of the instrument being in an out-of-control situation, say, every 10 or 20 samples, as opposed to finding out after several days in the field that you've been running and analyzing samples and you were out of control. This is similar to what folks use in the laboratory for control charting. And these are very simple things that you can make based on a DMA product, and then you actually use it, and this is how you're going to run your QC program if you're using that particular instrument in the field. And in this case, I'll just quickly mention how we often use this tool. In a general, what we do is you shoot your lead standard, your standard reference material in this case, and if the first measurement exceeds the two standard deviation rule, you would take it again, and that's using a 95 upper confidence limit, because even using that 95 upper confidence limit, you would expect that 5 out of 100 readings would be outside of the two standard deviation value. That's what a 95 UCL is. So you go ahead, you take that first QC shot with your standard reference material for lead, and if you're outside the two standard deviation shot, you would take a second shot of that standard without moving the instrument, because we just want to look at the analytical performance of the instrument. So you take that second shot, and if you're inside the two standard deviation window, then you're in control and you continue on. If you take a second shot and you're outside of the two standard deviation window, then you would reinitialize the instrument. If you take any single shot and you're three standard deviations away from the mean of what your expected concentration of that standard reference material should be, then you would go ahead and reinitialize the instrument. And all that means is you shut it down, you reinitialize the instrument, it reestablishes itself, and then you take a series of shots of blanks in your standard reference materials. In the case of XRF, for lead and arsenic, we often use the NIST materials for standard reference materials, things like NIST 2709, 2710, and 2711. So we use this control chart in conjunction with the standard reference materials to control for our analytes of interest as part of the QC program. So let's move to slide 26. I've shown now a number of examples of the types of products that we typically get out of a DMA. So now let's take some of those DMA results and translate them in.
Actually, before we move on, there was a question that came in online from Denver, Colorado, and they ask, what is the size of sample sets generally used to calculate uncertainty SLE? Would it vary depending on the class of contaminant that you are interested in?
So we're referring to the Navy uncertainty calculator? I've played with a number of different data sets in that. I think... there's a standard, if you go to that website, there is a standard operating procedure, and within that standard operating procedure, there may be recommendations for the specific numbers. But I've done it on a variety of data sets, anything from as small as, 10 to, 50 samples. So you can try it, and you can use it, and you can continue to refine those relationships as you move forward, but I don't, off the top of my head, have an exact number for what the Navy calculator recommends for the magic number of samples needed to do that calculation.
Thank you.
Sorry. But I will go back after this and take a look at the SOP, because I have a feeling it's in there. So let's go ahead and move to, again, slide 26. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to translate these DMA results now into some actionable pieces of your field program. So you can take the DMA results and try to develop things like I mentioned earlier, the field-based action levels or the upper and lower investigation levels. So you can optimize your standard operating procedures, your QA and QC programs, your statistical sampling design. You're going to have, if you are using dynamic work strategies, and hopefully with these real-time measurements you are, then you're really going to use those DMA results to develop things like decision rules, decision logic diagrams, and contingencies for how you're going to deal with when a technology doesn't work as expected in the field, or whether it's a drilling platform or whatever, and I have some examples of that. So this is really where the rubber hits the road. We're taking those valuable lessons that we've learned from the DMA, and we're translating them into a plan for how we're going to implement the use of these technologies, these sampling strategies, these data management plans as the site or the program progresses. So this is an iterative process. So the data relationships that you establish and the sampling implications can be actually refined as you go. But the DMA, that initial DMA, provides the platform from which to do this. So the earlier question was, how many samples do we need for the Navy calculator? I'm unsure of that at this point, but I can say that as the program is refined, you can continue to plug those samples into the Navy uncertainty calculator and get a better understanding of where your greatest uncertainty is coming from, and then try to deal with that as the program progresses. So that's really what we're trying to do, is take all these DMA lessons now and actually use them to develop sampling strategies, QA programs, and the like. So So first off, field-based action levels. You know, we mentioned those a little bit earlier. I had a couple examples of those. But what we're doing is we're taking action levels or values from our, whether it's a field analytical tool or a direct sensing tool, that's going to trigger an action. And those actions can be any number of things. It could be collection of a collaborative piece of information, that is, sending a sample off to laboratory analysis, taking a QC sample. Or those field-based action levels may trigger things like stepping out to define the limits of contamination, whether or not you may need additional sampling, whether or not you want to put a well there, what the well screens might be. All of those things are field-based action levels can be used to drive those decisions in the field, and I have some examples of some decision logic that shows that. But the field-based action levels allow you to make those decisions at the degree of confidence that you've specified with your stakeholders and your project team, so that you're not making decisions that haven't already been agreed upon in terms of the level of confidence that those tools are going to provide you in real time in the field. You've already made those determinations with your stakeholders and you have agreement. And that's really the power of what the DMA can do for you. And then, of course, remedy implementation. You can use those things for, okay, when do I stop removal? When do I collect a confirmation sample of, you know, an excavation is clean? And that's often required. We have that a lot where XRF will drive a removal program, and then at a certain point, the XRF meets its field-based action levels or thresholds that say that the trigger point is, okay, we think we're clean at this degree of confidence. We're going to go ahead and collect the sample for laboratory analysis, and that will be the final determination. And that is often at the behest of other stakeholders who want additional collaborative information, but at least with the DMA as your backup there, you can feel very confident that if you've made a decision with your field tool based on the DMA results at that desired level of confidence, that you can feel pretty good about when that sample goes off, it should come back in agreement. Now, that's not to say that there aren't times where the two methods don't agree. We call those, you know, false positives and false negatives, and I'll show some examples of those in a couple of minutes and how we try to deal with those, but you can never have 100% certainty from any analytical method, be it a field-based method or a laboratory method, that you know, you're just not going to get that level of certainty. So we live with things like 95% confidence or 99% confidence. Let's move to slide 28, and this is really the example that I'll use for the field-based action levels. Again, this is one that I took from our XRF materials, but this concept really could be used on any number of different technologies, immunoassay, fluorescence laser-induced fluorescence or other fluorescence techniques. But essentially what you're doing is taking on the y-axis, you see your XRF value. On the x-axis there, you see the laboratory method, and you're placing those on a scatter plot. In this case, we were trying to make decisions in the field about lead. So the action level for lead in this case in a residential setting was 400 ppm. So that line that you see running vertically there, it's supposed to represent the 400 ppm action level based on a laboratory number, an ICP, inductively coupled plasma number, coming back from the laboratory. So we took this DMA data set, a total of 59 pairs, where we had laboratory analysis and XRF analysis for lead. We plotted them up. In this case, we used a best fit line, but you could do this in a more simplistic fashion with simply a scatter plot. But we take the field-based action level. That is considered to be the quote-unquote true value. That is supposed to represent the true concentration, which we know has some inherent difficulties with that, but that's what we live with. So that vertical line is meant to represent 400 ppm from the lab. Now, if we were to take the best fit line and draw a line over to the y-axis, we see that it would correspond to a field-based action level for lead of about 450 ppm. So what we do is we take a look at the agreement of those two instruments to try to develop some investigation levels that we can use to make decisions with XRF in the field. So you take the same data set, and if you look up in the upper right-hand quadrant, you'll see that there are the true positive pairs. There are 19 of those out of 59. That is to say that both the XRF and the ICP agree that you are above your action level for lead and that it would be dirty. If you were to take a look in the upper left-hand side, you'll see that we have, or excuse me, let's go to the lower left-hand side into the true negative pair. So in there, we are in agreement. Both the ICP and the XRF agree that you are below your regulatory action level of 400 ppm for lead. So the problems or the issues with this technique lie in the lower right-hand quadrant, what we'll call the false negative. That is to say that the XRF told me I was below my field-based action level of 450, but if I were to send that sample off for ICP, my ICP would say that I'm above 400 ppm. So that would be, if we were making decisions in the field, that would be the more costly or the more dangerous of decision errors, because we would say with the XRF that we're done, this sample is clean, and if we were to send it off, we would actually have, send it off for laboratory analysis, we would actually have an issue. So we want to try to avoid that. Now up in the left-hand corner, you see that the false positives are examples where X-ray fluorescence said you were above your action level and therefore dirty, but if you were to send that same sample off for laboratory analysis, ICP would actually come back below 400. And those are your false positive errors. And those are generally, we shoot for error rates, and this is specific to how you design your project, but often the default values are 5% negative error rate and a 10% positive error rate that we're willing to live with these types of data sets in terms of decisions. So in this case, if we used a field-based action level of 450, we would have some pretty good error rates that we could live with, but we can improve on this process. So we're going to go ahead now and go to slide 29. So if we were to take the same data set and we want to reduce that false negative, we really don't want to have any decisions where we're making with XRF, where XRF would be in disagreement with the lab. So we move the action level down to 350 now. So now we're saying in the field, XRF, anything above 350 is dirty and anything below 350 is clean. That would reduce our false negative error to 0% rate. It would change only slightly the true positive number of pairs from 19 up to 20. The true negatives would actually decrease to 29 pairs, but the issue is the false positives. In this case, we'd be over-excavating because we would be making decisions with XRF or, you know, treating soil with XRF, whatever the remedy may be, at a false positive rate of 26%. And that may be too much for us to live with. So what we like to do is make what we call on slide 30 the three-way decision structure. So we're actually getting the best of both worlds. So if you were to take, normally I do this through a series of animations, but with the CLUIN platform as it is today, we'll just do it with a series of three slides, although Gene assures me that coming to a theater near you or in the very, very near future, I'll be able to actually do this with a series of animations. But if you move to the slide 30, you'll see that we basically have the best of both worlds now, and that's your upper investigation and lower investigation levels. So we've taken this DMA relationship, we've turned it into some decision points that we're going to be able to use now for XRF, for lead in the field, and here's how it would go. If I take a sample and it's below 350 with my XRF, I'm going to say it's clean. If I take a sample and it's above 450 with XRF, I'm going to say it's dirty. If I get a sample in between that 350 ppm value and that 450 ppm value, I would send it off for a definitive analysis for ICP at the lab. In this way, we get a data set that focuses our laboratory numbers on those samples that are in that region of uncertainty where it's too close to call, and we use the XRF to make decisions in terms of definitely clean, definitely dirty, above 450 and below 350. Now, you can continue to refine this data set as the project progresses. So every once in a while, if this were my side, I would maybe take a sample from down in the true negative pair side, and maybe another sample from the true positive pair side, just to make sure that my those relationships are still holding. So. Or at least give us an indication of whether we have an issue with the instrument. But what it allows you to do is to cut back on the number of fixed laboratory samples, really drive your expectations and your decisions with XRF, and yet maintain the low false negative error rate, in this case zero, and the limited false positive error rate of 7%, and really focus your ICP numbers on where they're going to provide the most bang for the buck, and that is in that 350 to 450 range.
Before you go on to the next slide, Steve, I just want to take a break. Does anyone on the phone lines have any questions? Remember, you can hit #6 to unmute your phone lines. Feel free to speak up. Okay, if no one has any questions on the phone lines, I don't see any more online. Go ahead.
Okay. So we'll go to slide 31. And, you know, I have a lot of examples of X-ray fluorescence, and, you know, August is X-ray fluorescence month here in the Cleland Studios, but I did want to provide an example of how you could use similar type non-parametric techniques to develop correlations between something like laser-induced fluorescence or response and the presence or absence of free product. So as you may recall, one of the DMA benefits, as I mentioned before, is your ability to correlate these two things. Correlate the response of a tool like LIF or MIF-ECD to a visual or chemical observation. So we're using paired, in this case, co-located boreholes to make some assumptions about response, and you can do this as part of the DMA. And this is an example from one of our technical support sites, but in this case, a series of LIF pushes were co-located with physical cores, and then they used the visual observations from the physical cores to try to identify a relative fluorescence value that would serve to estimate the presence or absence of free product petroleum, free phase petroleum products. Now that obviously differs with what the material is. So in this case, in a lighter signature with fewer PAHs to fluoresce, the relative fluorescence value greater than 50% was indicative of free phase product. The same can be said for oil in this case, where with higher numbers of PAHs, and you would expect higher relative fluorescence from those values, that when they got relative fluorescence values greater than 75%, that they assume the presence of free product. Now, you know, these relationships hold most of the time. There may be examples where they don't hold, but it's really valuable because in this case, they were using the LIF responses as a proxy to make some determinations and estimate potential volumes of contamination, mass in the ground, but also determine using the CPT logs and the LIF logs to determine product thickness such that they could optimize a product recovery system. So these are some simple things that you can take away from a DMA to give you some indication of how you're going to employ these in a dynamic fashion when you get out there. So in this case, the goal was to determine where is the free product, estimate some mass, and optimize a product recovery system, that you could use a DMA concept for laser-induced fluorescence in conjunction with some visual observations that I would recommend you standardize those visual observations, because when you have multiple people in the field, people describe things differently, and we have a series of texts to describe cores, physical cores for petroleum and other products that are kind of handy, but you standardize those observations, and then you have a real good tool for making determinations and getting an understanding of mass in the ground, product thickness, and really using that to then optimize a more elaborate LIF program and optimization of, in this case, a product recovery system. So that's an example of a non-X-ray fluorescence application of a DMA. Another thing we like to do, again, translating the DMA results, if we move to slide 32, optimizing standard operating procedures in QC programs. So I'll use three examples here, XRF, fluorescence tools, and immunoassay or bioassays, but for a tool like XRF, you would want to optimize what are the count times that you will operate the instrument at. XRF can be operated anywhere from 10 or 15 seconds to 6 minutes, and each doubling of runtime, quadruple the count time, in many cases you can cut the detection limit in half. So with the X-ray fluorescence tool, if you're having detection limit issues, one way to do it would be to increase your count time. So how long do you present the sample to the instrument? So if you had a 2-minute count time and you can only see the contaminant that you're interested, the metal that you're interested at 20 ppm, if you quadrupled that count time to 8 minutes, you might be able to see that sample down to 10 ppm. So that's kind of a nice rule of thumb. A quadrupling of the count time will cut your detection limit in half. So that's one of the things that you might want to try to look at in optimizing your SOP. And in many cases, you don't need a runtime that long. most often what we do is when we, as part of the DMA, when we get a determination of variance, we actually find that shorter 30-second shots placed in multiple places over a bag, for instance, provide a much better average concentration of the material in the bag than longer count times that would in turn get us slightly lower detection limits. But you want to think about, in terms of XRF, you'd want to think about, do we want to shoot it in bags? Do we want to prepare cups? Do we want to operate the instrument in situ mode? How are we going to prep the samples? And what will the frequency of things like blanks and standard reference materials? You can, in standard reference materials, I mentioned earlier, you have the NIST standards. You can also have a well-characterized sample from the site that we reuse over and over as a standard reference material. We do that as a site-specific SRM, and that's really nice to do. You can also even spike samples for XRF. So those are some of the types of things that you can optimize the SOP and the QC programs to do that. In terms of fluorescence, tools like laser-induced fluorescence, fuel fluorescence detectors, or even the ex-situ fluorescence tools, you want to maybe optimize drilling platforms. You can do things like fluorescence signatures, and some of those tools, in terms of LIF and some of these others, you actually get an indication of what are you looking at. Am I looking at gasoline or diesel or oil or what? You're using all those signatures that you've developed as part of the DMA to then make determinations as to how you're going to step out, how you're going to chase things, how you're going to collect samples in the field. So looking at the frequency and response thresholds, I mentioned some of those, and when you might collect collaborative samples. All of those can really be determined from a DMA application for those tools. And the same can really be said for tools like immunoassay and bioassay type tools, where you might want to think about whether or not composites are appropriate or multi-incremental samples are appropriate. I'll just make the distinction between the two now that the way we like to distinguish them here in TIFSTI is multi-incremental samples are multi-increments taken from within the same decision unit, whereas composites are multiple aliquots from multiple decision units, and there are advantages and limitations to using both of those. Suffice to say that you can also do things to optimize immunoassay and bioassay extraction procedures. I have a very brief example of the Wenatchee tree fruit example at the end of this presentation where they basically took the extract volume and doubled it, so that they can use the same extract to use on two different kits. So that's an idea of optimizing an SOP or a QC program based on the DMA. Moving to, what slide is that?
Slide 33.
I showed an earlier example of the QC program worksheet, and I mentioned kind of how we did it, so I probably won't get into this a whole lot, but again, this is an electronic version that we made, spreadsheet that we made, where again, as you get your specific analytes, in this case we had lead and arsenic and cadmium were of concern, so we made one of these control charts for each of those. As we ran our standard reference materials as part of our QC program, we plugged those in, and then as results were outside of two standard deviations or beyond three standard deviations, we had specified measures to deal with those, like reinitializing the instrument, reshooting your standards, making sure you're in control, and then continuing on from there. So that's just the electronic version of what you saw earlier. But again, you're taking information that you collected from the DMA and actually using it to create a QC program for these field analytics. And the thing about something like XRF, which is this is an example for, is again, oftentimes people take that initial correlation and they say, well, we did a correlation, and we got a correlation coefficient of 0.95, so the instrument's good. And that's all they use to make decisions with XRF. And that could be okay, but I think some of the earlier examples I showed with the three different decision pins and using a more elaborate QC program actually, in my mind, provide a much greater air of defensibility and really moves technologies like X-ray fluorescence into the realm of defensible data. And so that when people start to say, well, you used XRF, isn't that really a screening tool? I can go back and point to the results of my DMA, the results of my three-way decision logic, the results of my control charts, and all of those things, and they start to pile up in a very similar fashion that you would get from an analytical lab to really get folks and stakeholders and others to understand that these we're making very confident decisions with these tools. So let's go ahead and move to slide 34. And one of the other nice parts about conducting a DMA is actually helping optimize your statistical sampling plan. It's really hard to have a statistical sampling plan without some knowledge of variability and other things in the matrix. So here we have an example, and folks may be aware, this happens to be an example from Visual Sampling Plan, a tool that is a very powerful tool but can be misused. In fact, they've, at our behest, they've gone so far as to add a module called the Sentinel, which basically, as you plug values into here, taps you on the shoulder and says, where did you get this value from? Are you sure this makes sense? Because, as you'll see in the following slide, you know, as you add these numbers, it has a tremendous impact on how many samples you're supposed to take for a particular decision unit. So in this case, you have a false rejection rate and a false acceptance rate of 5 and 10%. I mentioned those are often the values that we used earlier. You're using a true mean, and that is, you know, are we characterizing or verifying cleanup? Because the assumption one way is dirty, the assumption the other way is clean. Again, the statistical confidence desired with the false rejection rate and false acceptance rate. The width of the gray region, that refers to how close the true mean is to the action level. And, you know, that's a number that often escapes people. But if you have a DMA, yes, you don't have a true mean, but you have a really good understanding of what the likely mean is and how close it is to your true action, to your action level, you actually have a much better value to plug into that width of gray region rather than some of the defaults or other ways that folks get at those numbers. And then finally, the estimated standard deviation. And that was really the big one for us because the first couple times I used Visual Sampling Plan, when I went in there, there was actually a default value of 3 for the estimated standard deviation. And I don't know of too many data sets that have a standard deviation of 3. So what a DMA can do for you is actually help give you a realistic estimate of how much variability is present in the soil conditions. And oftentimes, that number is significantly larger than 3. So again, one of the knowledge pitfalls here of using classical statistical tools like those used in VSP is that project teams seldom have a sound estimate of what the total measurement is for establishing sample quality, sample quantities, grid sizes, measurement, and so on. So with results from a DMA, you can actually better use classical statistical tools like VSP more effectively in sample design because you've generated a site-specific method error information. So that's really a nice thing. If you're going to use something like VSP and you have some field analytics or innovative sampling strategies that you want to employ at the site, part of the DMA is actually to give you some real numbers to get into VSP or other similar decision support tools. Let's go ahead and move to slide 35. I mentioned this earlier, but as you can see, you know, if you choose wisely what those estimates are, because in this case, if you look at the gray region width, depending on how you make that determination and the standard deviation, you could have, you know, if you assume a gray region width of 350 and a standard deviation of 50, VSP would tell you you have to take 2 samples in that decision unit. Whereas if you assumed a gray region width of 100 and a standard deviation of 300, VSP would tell you you need 79. So you're actually plugging in, you know, realistic values based on the DMA to actually have an understanding of how many samples you would need. And then as those sample numbers increase, you see the value of those real-time higher density analytical tools to actually control the real-life variability that's there and driving that high standard deviation and driving that gray region width. Let's move to slide 36. One of the other pieces of decision logic that are outputs of a DMA are really defining a decision logic, and I have many examples of that. If folks want to email me, I can provide other examples. There's lots on Triad Central and the Triad Community Practice and others, but we're taking these lessons learned from the DMA and translating them into actual how we're going to operate in the field. In this case, we had a facility. We were going to collect a number of in situ readings in each within each grid, and then depending on the value of those in situ readings and whether or not a certain percentage of them or number of them exceeded the action limit, we were driven to shooting additional in-situ shots, taking an ex-situ bag sample, or sending material off for a lab. So this is just one example of decision logic that was used for XRF, but you could do any number of similar types of things with other field analytical tools like immunoassay, fluorescence techniques, and others. So this is a pretty good example of how we translate DMA information into its decision logic. Along the same lines, let's move to slide 37. Along the same lines of decision logic, we like to develop decision rules. And this happens to be an example of a decision rule that we developed for XRF. In this case, we had bag samples. We had a number of measurements that we were going to take through the bag. And we needed a decision rule for how many measurements we needed to make a confident decision for each bag. So in this case, the action level was 25 ppm. We had three bag samples that were systematically measured across each bag, 10 times each, and we got average concentrations of 19, 22, and 32 ppm for each bag. Now the key here is that we wanted the bags to be close to the action level. So with XRF, it's kind of nice to go find those samples that are close to your action level of 25, because as you increase those numbers, the histogram that I'll show in the next slide becomes more problematic. But in this case, we knew we had an action level of 25. We had three bag samples that we were going to measure 10 times each, and we're going to look at the average concentrations of those. And the determination of the average concentration for each of those bags was 19, 22, and 32. So we had a total of 30 measurements. So let's go to slide 38. And this is an example of a simple decision rule that we were able to make with those 30 measurements. In this case, if you were to create a histogram from those 30 measurements, immediately you got a fairly normal distribution, and immediately a couple of things jumped out at us, and that is we didn't get any results below 10, and we didn't get any results greater than 50. So we made some simple decision rules based on that 30 measurement determination for how many measurements we were going to take on each bag at the site in this way. If the first measurement is taken and it's less than 10 ppm, we would stop and assume clean and not take any additional measurements. If the first measurement was greater than 50, we would stop and assume that we are exceeding action levels. You can always go back and shoot these bags additionally if you want, but these are very quick decision rules for, you know, a high density data set that we're doing in the field. And the last one is, if the first measurement is between 10 ppm and 50 ppm, we would take another three measurements and then determine the average concentration and see if we can have a decision from there. So you can have a series of these decision rules trickling down to really hone in on samples that are really close to the action level with a high degree of variability and get rid of those samples that are obviously clean or obviously dirty simply by using XRF. And that's an example of how we did that. So if we go ahead and move to slide 39, the final piece that I'll mention that DMAs are really nice is to support development of contingencies. And in this case, I'm talking about contingencies. You know, not only can you have contingencies for technologies, like when do I need to send a sample off to the laboratory, but also contingencies for drilling platforms. So this is actually this example here is actually a subset of a much larger, more comprehensive decision logic for some triad work that was completed at Hurlburt Field. But this portion of decision logic focuses on contingencies whose necessity was determined during a DMA. So the concern here in this case was to have a drilling platform that was capable to reach their desired depths. And the DMA indicated that they needed some contingencies here because they may have some issues with refusal. So the contingencies included options for sonic drilling, core analysis in lieu of CPT information, and laboratory analysis, and well placement, well screen intervals, and et cetera. So by conducting a DMA with the MIP, they had some understanding of how they would use the response values to make determinations to hone in on source areas, but also they had contingencies for when they got refusal, they could bring other things to bear on those and put monitoring wells in or take laboratory samples as needed such that they could, you know, This is particularly helpful for a dynamic work strategy where you're trying to limit mobilizations and maximize the value of the real-time information. So the concept of contingencies isn't just for analytical, but actually extends out to drilling platforms and other logistical issues. So if we move to slide 40, I'll just touch on couple of lessons learned, and these are some lessons learned for myself from doing DMAs over the last couple of years now. And again, linear regression can be extremely helpful as a parametric technique, but it can also be misleading. So remember, don't just focus on that R-squared value. In general, we have a rule of thumb. We like 20 or more paired samples to do a good regression. Paired results should focus on the concentration ranges that are pertinent to your decision making. So with XRF, if you get a value that's 20,000 and your action level is 400, I wouldn't fret about that. And that can actually mess up some of your regressions. So you may want to trim your data sets down into the area of interest, because at a certain point you're beyond the linearity of the instrument. Again, non-detects removed or appropriate substitution methods used. No evidence of inexplicable outliers, no correlated residuals, high R-squared values, and remember the constant residual variance or lack thereof.
Well, Steve takes a break. If anybody on the phone lines has any questions, feel free to press #6 to unmute your phone lines. You can also use that question mark icon at the top of your screen to submit a question online.
Hello, this is Jim Wolf in Denver.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, I've got a question. I recently took a field analytic kit out that tests for VOCs, and it was the ColorTech, and we sent off about 8 samples, various responses to a lab, and qualitatively we feel like we had a really good relationship, and we're going to, you know, go out in the field again and get, you know, another kit and try to expand this. But the thing was, they only sent us a couple of mid-range and one high-range response kit or tube. And so we have some greater thans. And do I just have to throw those out of the set, or is there a way to treat it? And do you use non-parametric instead of regression? Would you throw them out, or would you do something else?
Well, I assume that are the greater than values significantly higher than your action levels?
Yes.
Because at a certain point, if you're in that range with the kit, it's unlikely that you would have a corresponding lab value that would be below your action level. So to me, it's almost a moot point. In other words, if the mid-range is around the value of where you're making decisions in terms of, you know, clean or dirty or extent of the plume or whatever, I'm not sure what you can do, because, I mean, I assume you do like a dilution on the high end for those high end kits.
Yes, there is. It does have a dilution kind of procedure.
I mean, if you have a correspond, I would actually maybe do a series. I would look at how it looks just focusing on the mid range values, and then, you know, just for the heck of it, in my mind, I would see how it performs on the higher end. But you're almost mixing data sets there. You know, you have a mid-range value from one data set and a high-range value from basically a different extraction procedure, or at least a dilution. So your uncertainty around that value is going to be greater just from the dilution, but it probably would correlate okay with the values. But I'm not sure I would mix the two data sets.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not sure I would mix the high-value data with the other and create one correlation.
Well, yeah, the low values, the regular data set would be good for determining if it's clean or dirty, but we might also want to make a set of decisions based on, should we, like, blast an area with, you know, use a treatment option like blasting it with Chemox or something like that, which would be more in the high level, like up PPM levels.
Right, so, I mean, your decision logic is pretty simple at that point. If you get something that's in the high range, you can take a collaborative sample at a certain percentage if that's what you need for optimizing the remedy. But in terms of decision, your collaborative samples, if you're trying to make clean or dirty decisions, then you want your collaborative samples down in that low kit range.
Right. Yeah, you can almost go to, if you have to go to this next range, then you've got your answer, sort of thing.
Yeah, you have a decision. If you go to mid-range, then you want to evaluate the sample for, as you said, blasting it with whatever remedy you have. So you got a couple different decisions. You can make a decision tree to when you leave from one, when you go from one kid to the other, what does that do to your action?
Okay. Well, that's helpful. Thanks.
Any other questions on the phone line?
I think I got my voice back.
Okay. Well, feel free to proceed. We're still on slide number 40.
The other thing I'll say about linear regression, again, is that standard laboratory data can be noisy, and they're not necessarily an error-free representation of reality. In fact, several of the DMAs I've been involved with resulted in finding laboratory issues based on comparability analysis with field analytics. So it's kind of nice to make that determination when the two aren't matching up very well. You know, immediately folks point their finger at the field technology and say, well, that just doesn't work. And in several cases, we found that actually there was a reporting issue from the laboratory, and that was kind of the one that was thrown off the relationship, whether it was parametric or non-parametric, that we were trying to build. So kind of nice to have that as an additional check on the laboratory, too. Remember those weight of evidence and collaborative definitions that I mentioned. So we tend to get hung up on how close is the field result to the lab, when the reality is the DMA can help identify both lab and field issues or mistakes, sampling issues, subsampling issues, heterogeneity, and all of those things can have a much greater impact on your project than solely focusing on that field analytical value as a piece of information that you're going to make a decision on. So the other thing I'll say is that focus on decision quality. We mentioned that, so don't just solely focus on those two comparability values, but think about how to structure your contracts to include some of the DMA principles. I gave the geophysics example, where if we had structured the contract a little bit different and they came out and they couldn't see to the right depth after day one, we could have told them to either bring out another piece of equipment or move on, basically, because we would have structured the contract in such a way to either have them get out the equipment that they say could see to the depth that we needed to, or at least be aware of that prior to doing the full survey and really getting a bunch of information that was not of great value, and then having to pay for that information. The last thing I'll say is that particular instruments do not equal a generalization about technology. And I had just a couple examples in terms of membrane interface vendors. We don't condone any specific advocate for any specific vendor, but there are a number of different types of vendors and platforms out there. And the thing I would say is ask to see the information or the information that you'll be using to make decisions, because I've had anything from a really nice real-time 3D visualization to a spreadsheet. And so, just assuming that I'm using XRF, so it's, and I have a good correlation is enough, or I'm using MIP, so that's enough. You know, there's a tremendous variety in the vendor qualifications, and that as a service, you really want to make sure that you're using these tools in a real-time fashion, because that's where the power lies. And if you're using a MIP or an LIF or even an XRF in a static fashion to not drive a dynamic work strategy, you're losing out on a lot of power. So, not all vendors are created equal. Another example I had was we did a great DMA with an XRF instrument, and then I got a call back from some folks involved with the project, and they wanted to know if they could use these other three instruments and then base that on the DMA. And there's some crossover there, because you're talking about the same technology, but I also said you're talking about completely different instruments from different vendors that now haven't been tested on the site matrix. So a lot of that really beneficial information that you got from the initial DMA kind of falls off a little bit on the back end, because now you want to use a completely different older unit. They did a DMA with a tube-based newer unit, and then wanted to translate those DMA results to an older radioactive source instrument, and I wasn't very comfortable with that. So just remember that you can't generalize about a particular technology and assume that because you're using XRF or LIF, that you're going to get the same results. So ask to see the information that you're going to use to make decisions, and make sure examples of the types of information that you're going to receive, and make sure that that's going to meet your needs. let's move now finally to the last quick example, and this is one of the three examples that we provide in the DTSC technical bulletin for DMAs. And this site's actually about 15 years old now, but I really like it because it still provides a lot of the good data demonstration of methods applicability and triad concepts, where they took, in this case, immunoassay, they took a technology and refined it in the field as they were going, and then used that information to drive both the QC program, but also, if you look on the second bullet, the DMA supported really an integrated characterization, removal, and segregation of waste effort. So this site was in Washington State. It was a test plot for that the agricultural agency out there used to test the fate and transport of different organochlorine and organophosphorus and actually some other pesticide compounds. So it had a whole mishmash of different organochlorine, organophosphorus, carbamate, and other pesticide compounds out there. They performed a DMA as part of that expedited characterization and dynamic work strategy that they did, and then that DMA and the information from that DMA then was really integrated into the characterization, simultaneous characterization, removal, and segregation. So the DMA looked at immunoassay test kits and and fixed laboratory methods. They looked at both. If we move to slide 42, some of the findings of the DMA. Well, the DMA confirmed that the immunoassay test kits were biased high, and for their purposes for this project, that was actually okay. They were biased high by the manufacturer to reduce the chance of false negatives, and if you remember from some of the earlier slides, that's the more dangerous of the two decision errors, where your test kit would say you don't have an issue, and then if you were to send that off, you did. So they actually wanted a high bias on these kits. And they also had to account for the fact that the kits respond to, in this case, structurally similar compounds beyond those target compounds. So they used two kits in this particular case for chlordane and DDT kits. And so they took into consideration the high bias that they got from the DMA and the correlations with the fixed laboratory results. And they determined a field-based action level for the DDT test kit that of 5 ppm, and that would indicate an exceedance of either DDT, DDD, or DDE. They did the same with the cyclodiene test kit, and a 0.1 ppm action level was indicative of the potential exceedance for either dieldrin or endrin. So the modifications that they made to the method was actually they doubled the extraction volume so that they could use the same extraction volume for the same kits. So that resulted in some less issues with heterogeneity and subsampling issues. So they doubled the extraction volume. This is in working consultation with the manufacturer so that they were able to use the spectrophotometer from a single extract for both kits. So they made some modifications there. They also made some modifications to the fixed laboratory methods that they used in conjunction or in collaboration with these tools. And For the organophosphorus pesticide, they use mass spec detection instead of the specified NPD or nitrogen phosphorus detector. And the reason for that was to improve selectivity and meet their quantitation limits that they were trying to get. In the case of the carbamate pesticides, they had a gas GC with nitrogen phosphorus detector that was used instead of the high-pressure liquid chromatography or HPLC method, and the intent of that modification was to reduce interference and interference associated with the HPLC, and also they changed the surrogate compound that was used because there was such a mishmash of chemicals out here and pesticide compounds that they actually had to change one surrogate because one of the surrogates was found on site. So again, some of the modifications, they also looked at things like tentatively identified compounds, and they really became crucial for understanding immunoassay kit response from a whole range of different contaminants. So they took the DMA and the subsequent results, and as the program progressed in real time, they were able to actually adjust the action level for the DDT kits to 10. So from the initial DMA, it was 5. But as they continued to refine their relationship with some collaborative samples, they found that they could make the same decisions with the same level of confidence by upping the field-based action level from 5 ppm to 10. In the case of the cyclodiene kit, it was left at 0.1 ppm for the entire time. And ultimately the results were they had no false negative decision errors, a very low percentage of false positives where they may have excavated stuff that the kit said was dirty and laboratory sample would have said that they were actually clean. So we've got about 10 minutes left, and for a more in-depth look at that case study, I provided on slide 41, I provided the link there. You can go ahead and take a look at the Wenatchee tree fruit. The focus of the case study is on the dynamic work strategy applications, but it was of particular interest to me from a DMA perspective because I saw all those components that I've been hammering on for the last hour and a half. I saw embodied in this thing. And this work was actually done 15 years ago and really became one of our early triad type pilots and triad case studies that we used to promote things like real-time measurement technologies, dynamic work strategies, and systematic planning. So if we go ahead and go to slide 43, which you can't see the number on because I've covered it with the triad symbol, there's just a list of some resources, some places to go. Again, with the Technology Integration and Information Branch of the Technology Innovation Field Services Division. So there's some information on us there. There's a number of case studies on DMAs and similar type projects at triadcentral.org. Keep an eye out on CLUIN and, as I mentioned earlier in the talk, on the BTSC website for when the performing a DMA under a triad approach comes out. The expectation is basically the next couple of weeks it should be out, so we expect it out in 2008. And then also I would encourage folks to take a look at the Triad Community of Practice folks. I would ask around, and there's a point of contact, Carolyn Peroni, for the Triad Community of Practice, and there's a number of practitioners who belong to that community of practice who have a lot of experience with things like DMAs, and you can really pick their brains, get some good examples, and we also have a website where we share information, and some of those things can really make nice templates for helping you out with some DMAs. And with that, I'll move to the final slide, 44, and see if we have any additional questions or if we want to have some dialogue at this point.
Again, if you have put your phone on mute, you can unmute it now or press #6 to unmute the phone line. I don't see any more questions that have been submitted online, so you can feel free to speak up verbally if you have any other comments or inquiries for Steve.
I'll just assume I've answered all your questions.
You have. It's rather very thorough in those slides. So if there aren't any other questions right now, again, Steve's contact information is located at the seminar homepage, which you were sent by email, as well as you can get to by clicking on the icon with a small house on the top of the slides today. That'll bring you back to the homepage where you can download the slides. If everyone could move ahead to slide number 45, which is the last slide in today's seminar session, you should have a link to two things. Number one, the links to additional resources, which will have links to download some of the documents that Steve mentioned, as well as take a look at a few related websites. And then the other second important link there is our feedback form. It'll just take you a few seconds. If you could follow that link and give us your comments and feedback, we do read them and try to make improvements based off of your comments. There'll also be an option if you click on that link on the feedback form to check a box to have a confirmation email sent your way so you can keep as a record of your participation in today's event. So if there are no comments or questions, as we mentioned earlier at the start of today's session, this entire event will be recorded and made available as part of the CLUIN archive. You'll be able to find it at cluin.org. We expect to have the archive up in about 1 to 2 weeks. It also will be available on our podcast if you're a subscriber there. So if there aren't any other questions, this will be the conclusion of today's event. I thank Steve for his time and his information today, as well as his voice, which did a good job there for 2 hours.
Really?
Thank all of you for joining us on the line. And if you have questions, feel free to contact Steve or myself, and I hope to see you or hear from you on another CLUIN session in the future. Thank you.